My name is Jack Nelson Pallmeyer, and this session is on the war against the poor, and it looks at U.S. warfare strategy in Central America and elsewhere called low-intensity conflict. My temptation is to want to give about an hour and 20-minute talk, but I'm not going to do that. I'd rather make less of a strong case for the points I'm trying to make and have time for questions and comments from you. But just to call your attention to, I know floating around the village is this issue of global perspectives, and it has an article that I did called The War Against the Poor. So if people are interested in kind of a short summary of some of the issues I'll talk about, you can find it in here. And then if you want more, I know there were some copies of War Against the Poor. I don't think there are any now, but there may be in the bookstore at some point. So with that in mind, I'll try to provide a summary of what low-intensity conflict is, at least from my perspective, and how I come to my conclusions. Maybe start out with a quote from George Orwell. Many of you will remember him from his book 1984. Orwell was a pretty sophisticated critic of nationalism, and he once wrote, quote, "There is no crime, absolutely none, that cannot be condoned when our side commits it. Loyalty is involved, and so pity ceases to function," end quote. He also said, and another time, he said, "The nationalist not only does not disapprove of atrocities committed by their own side, he or she has a remarkable capacity for not even hearing about them," end quote. I think that those are accurate summaries of low-intensity conflict. It's a term that we don't hear very much about, but much more important than the term is the policy behind the term. Let me just say that a little bit about what low-intensity conflict means. Low-intensity conflict is, I didn't invent the term, it's a term from the Pentagon, it's a military term, and where it first started to be thrown about in a major way was following the Vietnam War, and when there was a reassessment and thinking about what happened to the United States in Vietnam. Then all of a sudden you had a lot of military planners, a lot of military generals, a lot of people within the military who started to study what happened there, and they became convinced that the real major threats to the security interests of the United States were in the Third World. And so part of what low-intensity conflict is, in their terminology, is it's threats to U.S. national security interests that are short of nuclear war and different than regular conventional war. And usually they're of less intensity of conflict than either of those. So that's where the term low intensity comes from. It's less intense, supposedly, than nuclear war or a conventional exchange, say, between the United States and the Soviet Union. Low intensity conflict also has come to mean and refer to the strategy by which the U.S. defends its interests in the Third World. It's a very sophisticated strategy, and that's the strategy that I'm going to be talking about tonight. But one other thing to say as we begin, low-intensity conflict is also an Orwellian term, because low-intensity conflict causes high-intensity pain. Any of you who have had the opportunity to live or work or visit Central America will see some of the incredible human suffering that results as a consequence and as part of the policy of low-intensity conflict. I want to read one quote to you that I have in the book War Against the Poor. And it was told to me by a campesino in Salvador, in El Salvador, almost a year ago. It says, quote, "By a miracle I am able to tell you the story of my grand crime for which they threatened me with death. They took my son who was 18 years old, shot him, peeled off his skin and cut him into pieces. Then they hung him from a cross in a tree. They cut his testicles off and put them in his mouth. They did this to warn me because I was a celebrator of the Word of God. That was my crime. We had to leave because they persecuted the whole land. Our crime is to be poor and ask for bread. Here the laws only favor the rich. However, the great majority of people are poor. Those who have jobs are exploited daily in the factories and on the farms. Without land, we cannot plant. There is no work. This brings more hunger, more misery. We are without clothes, schools, or jobs. And so we demonstrate. But to speak of justice is to be called a communist. To ask for bread is subversive. It is a war of extermination. It is a crime to be a Christian and to demand justice. End quote. The basic background for me in understanding low-intensity conflict is this, that somewhere around 40 million people die each year from hunger or hunger-related causes. Poor people who live in Central America, who live in the Philippines, who live in a lot of other societies, are basically victimized twice. They're victimized by an international economy that is structured in ways that doesn't meet their basic needs, an international economy that has much more to do with the movement of goods and services to meet the desires of the rich and the affluent rather than meet the basic needs of the poor. And they are also victimized by internal systems, systems within their own countries that are structured to meet the interests of elites and not their interests. So for the world's poor, which means the vast majority of people who are living in the third world, they desperately need changes in both the international economy and the way it works and the way their own societies are structured. Low-intensity conflict, in a nutshell, is the U.S. strategy to make sure that those changes can happen, to block those changes, to maintain privilege at the expense of the poor. Hopefully from that quote you get a sense that low-intensity conflict causes high-intensity pain. Let me just give you one other example. If we wanted to think in parallel terms with the number of people who have been killed in Nicaragua as a result of a so-called low-intensity conflict strategy of the United States, it would be the equivalent of more than 2 million U.S. citizens in the past 6 years. Now, can you imagine a situation in which a foreign power was sponsoring a war against the United States, in which two million U.S. citizens died, that we would term low-intensity? Not very likely. So the term itself I'm uncomfortable with, and yet it's the term that the Pentagon uses, and so it's the one that I'm trying to get inside of. One other piece of background. I told the Sojourner group today that probably the most painful thing that I've done in a long time has been coming to terms with what low-intensity conflict means and writing about it. The desire and the search to try to find out what was going on with U.S. policy, what was behind U.S. policy in Central America, really began with a lot of troubling questions that I had in living there, and I'll just lift up a few of those. One troubling question was, I kept on hearing reports that the United States and the Reagan administration was saying that it was going to do away with terrorism, that it was opposed to terrorism, and yet what I witnessed in Central America was that terrorism was absolutely central to U.S. policy in terms of what was taking place by the Salvadoran government that we backed and in terms of what the Contras did daily in Nicaragua. The Contras' principal tactic during the years I lived in Nicaragua was terrorism against civilians. So how come the difference between the rhetoric and the reality? Another question was, how could it be that Nicaragua, a country of 3 million people, or the tiny country of El Salvador with very few resources, could be perceived as a national security threat to the United States? To the point, in the case of Nicaragua, that we in this country right now are living under a state of national emergency. I don't know how many of you know that. U.S. citizens are living under a state of national emergency because the Reagan administration and soon the Bush administration has certified that Nicaragua is such a grand threat to U.S. security interests. Now, any of you who have been to Nicaragua and see how poor it is, you will understand how ridiculous that is. So, but why? Why was it a threat? Another question was, the U.S. said that it was interested in some things in the case of Nicaragua, for example, that maybe are legitimate. For example, the U.S. has said, we don't want the Soviet Union to have a military base in Nicaragua. Fine. Nicaragua has said, we don't want a Soviet military base. We're willing to sign either a regional treaty, a treaty directly with the United States, etc. That's just one example of many that I could name in which the U.S. said, the reason we're trying to destroy Nicaragua is because of X. And Nicaragua said, oh, fine, we'll do X. We have no problem with that. We don't want any military bases. Let's sign an agreement. Why was it, I asked myself, did the U.S. try to undermine every meaningful peace agreement in Central America that would have achieved the publicly stated goals that the United States government was stating? Very, very confusing. Fourth question I had was, why did the U.S. media so easily and readily adopt the parameters of debate that was set in Washington? Why so much of the news that we get in the mainstream media essentially determined by the voices in Washington? And then how distorted that was compared to the reality that at least I saw and experienced in Central America. A fifth question I had was, why, if the U.S. was committed to democracy, did we ignore the fact that Nicaragua had elections in 1984 that got good grades in terms of the international community saying that Nicaragua had fair and free elections? Or why did we carry out elections in El Salvador that were probably far less free, and yet we refer to El Salvador as an emerging democracy? If we were concerned about democracy, why this contradiction? And then finally, and there were many, many more questions, but finally one more to lift up in this context. Why was the U.S. government willing to publicly attack liberation theology and in its internal documents basically target liberation theology as an enemy while it provided all kinds of ideological and perhaps financial support to conservative, right-wing, fundamentalist sects who were operating throughout Central America? Okay, all of those things, in addition to the tremendous human suffering that I experienced and saw and witnessed firsthand in Central America, led me to probe what was meant by low-intensity conflict. And so I'm drawing in this brief presentation tonight on a lot of personal experiences and trying to sort it out, but also having read a lot of U.S. government documents on what our Pentagon leaders, military leaders, and others say about low-intensity conflict. Okay, start out with a few words, and I'm going to really try to be brief here. Few words on the worldview that undergirds low-intensity conflict. First, according to U.S. military planners, and low-intensity conflict, by the way, has basically participation in shaping it from the Pentagon, different military branches, the State Department, the White House, the National Security Council, Agency for International Development, the CIA. It's a very broad range thing that's being put together with a lot of voices. Okay, the first part of the worldview is that peace doesn't exist. Peace is an illusion. The United States is and always will be at war. And if we are not actively fighting wars, then we will be losing ground. So that's one part, piece of the worldview. The closest they get to talking about peace is basically it's a kind of peace through perpetual warfare. That's the image they have. Second part of the worldview is that there's no such thing as a legitimate revolution. There's no such thing as an authentic revolution. Nicaragua cannot possibly be trying to get rid of a U.S.-backed dictator and to carve out its own future. It must be, according to this worldview, a puppet of the Soviet Union. It must be a puppet of someone else. It can't be legitimate internal grievances. Third part of the worldview is that non-alignment is a contradiction in terms. The U.S., under the low-intensity conflict parameter, basically gives third world countries two options. They can be controlled by the United States, or they will be an enemy of the United States. You can have your choice. And part of what's at stake in Nicaragua, the reason that the U.S. has focused so much attention on trying to destroy Nicaragua, is as a sign to other movements and groups around the world, other countries around the world, that they have those two choices. They could either be dominated by the United States or they will be targeted as enemy. A fourth part of the worldview is that any threat to a U.S. interest around the world, no matter how small, is viewed as an attack against the United States. So something happening in this little country of Nicaragua, 3 million people, they throw out a U.S.-backed dictator. They're not throwing out a dictator, they're attacking the United States, according to this worldview. Very closely related to that as part of the worldview is that any threat to a U.S. interest, no matter how small, no matter how tiny, is seen as a fundamental attack against the entire global system. So the Kissinger Commission report a number of years ago, a bipartisan commission, basically said, what's at stake here is our credibility worldwide. If we allow anywhere a change to take place outside of what we suggest and recommend, we are allowing the whole system to crumble, because that's what's being attacked. Another part of the worldview is that World War III has now been redefined. According to low-intensity conflict planners, we are already fighting World War III, but World War III, contrary to many of our perceptions, is not a direct conflict with the Soviet Union. World War III is being fought in the Third World. World War III is being fought on the periphery or on the edges of the empire. At the end of the Vietnam War, in assessing what was facing the United States, General Maxwell Taylor had this to say. He said, quote, as the leading have nation, we may expect to have to fight to protect our national valuables against envious have-not peoples, end quote. The war against the poor. The shift now is that we're not as likely to have a direct exchange with the Soviet Union. We're spending too much of our resources there. We're worried too much about Western Europe and Eastern Europe. The real struggle is in the Third World, and the United States has to be better able to intervene there. Now, just as a little bit of an aside, but something that I'll throw out because I think it's important, is that you, I would guess that many of you in this room would share with me a certain kind of hopefulness about the warming relationship between the United States and the Soviet Union. If the Cold War can somehow be melted a little bit, maybe that can free up other resources for human needs. Maybe we can start confronting environmental issues and a whole lot of problems. I hope that's true. But from what's happening, I believe, from the perspective of low-intensity conflict planners is there's being a calculated decision made that in order to free the resources up to better intervene in the Third World, we've got to improve relationships with the Soviet Union. And what the goal is among some of our planners is to see if we can't form an alliance with the Soviet Union against the Third World. So, be hopeful, be glad, but don't be happy. Because there's some very sinister stuff lurking in the background. And if we're not careful, what this is really translating as is, okay, we're putting too much resources into Western Eastern Europe, we're going to take those resources and we're going to intervene more effectively in the Philippines, in Nicaragua, in El Salvador, and in other third world countries. Finally, in terms of worldview, they've redefined the concept of total war. Total war, in my mind, used to be all-out nuclear exchange. Total war under low-intensity conflict is warfare against the whole human person. It's warfare in which you try to control the hearts and minds, the economic choices, the political options of people, communities, and even nations. The totalitarian strategy that links together economic, political, diplomatic, psychological, and military aspects of warfare. And I'm going to give you some examples of each of those a little bit later on. Okay, I have a whole section here that I'm just going to skip, and I'll just ask you to think about how could we possibly conceive of a worldview that would be more different and radically opposed to the biblical worldview than that, in terms of how it treats the poor, in terms of how it views peace, a whole lot of things. terrible conflict there that as people of faith we need to come back to, or we need to come to terms with. All right. I mentioned earlier that low-intensity conflict, the strategy, has been shaped by lessons that were learned in previous counterinsurgency efforts, particularly Vietnam. So let me just touch briefly on what some of those lessons were. These are not the lessons that I would have learned from Vietnam, but these are the lessons that our military planners and our government leaders learned, and it's based on those lessons that they've brought us this very sinister strategy of low-intensity conflict. First lesson is, warfare is not fought primarily to control territory. Warfare is fought primarily to control people's hearts and minds. And the goal of warfare must be to separate people from revolutionary movements. In the case of Nicaragua, you want to try to separate the people from the Sandinistas who carried out a revolution on their behalf and with them. In the case of El Salvador, you want to try to separate the people who have a lot of reasons why they're supportive of the FMLN, for example, the guerrilla groups fighting the U.S.-backed government in El Salvador. There are different ways you can try to separate. And I'll just give you a couple of examples. In El Salvador, one way is the U.S. pushed what I call a cosmetic land reform. Well, why did the U.S. do that? Land reform is absolutely essential in El Salvador and a lot of other places. So the U.S. comes in and it pushes a land reform program. That sounds good. But it really left the basic land relationships intact. It was a cosmetic reform that was done more for publicity and psychological purposes, because the FMLN has its strongest base of support among campesinos. And it's been promising radical land reform for years and years. So the U.S. tries to do a cosmetic job. Well, as you're probably aware, cosmetic reforms probably aren't going to be very effective in really changing people's hearts and minds. So then there was another strategy in El Salvador. And that strategy was to bomb the hell out of the people. And we did. We carried out massive bombings that we almost never heard a thing about in this country against civilian targets, displaced well more than 1 million people out of 5 million people in El Salvador through those bombings, engaged in all kinds of psychological warfare, terrorism against civilians that I'll come back to, as a way of trying to separate people from a revolutionary movement. A second lesson that was learned from Vietnam is that the real challenge facing U.S. leaders is to protect perceived U.S. interests, but let other people do the dying. You've all heard the term Vietnam syndrome. Essentially what it means is that the U.S. people are a little shell-shocked after Vietnam. They're a little reluctant to send their own troops in. They're a little reluctant to protect their own interests boldly around the world. And so we're going to have to do it for them. And the best way to do that is to find ways of having other people do the dying. So you don't want U.S. soldiers coming back in body bags. So what do you do instead? You train other people's armies. You create and arm the Contras. You build up the Salvadoran military. You build up the Honduran military. You build up the Filipino military, etc. You don't have a draft, because if you had a draft on college campuses, you'd have a lot more political activism. You send your National Guard and your National Reserves down to be trained in places like Central America for the eventuality of an invasion, rather than sending your troops in to actually invade. It's a lower profile way of getting the training that you need. You develop quick strike forces capable of Grenada type invasions, where you can go in, not get locked in a ground war, but go in on a very quick basis, because you know that the U.S. people are squeamish about a ground war in which a lot of their own troops will be killed. Basically, under low-intensity conflict strategy, the introduction of a large number of U.S. troops is a policy of last resort. It's a policy that you'll use if your low-intensity conflict strategy has failed, or perhaps you'll use it if you've had other people do most of the dying for you and you can send your troops in at the last moment for a quicker strike, shorter period of time, if you've softened things up. And then finally, in relation to this point, the reliance upon secret teams, covert operations, is related to the desire not to use your upfront troops that are visible, not to have a public draft, etc., you try to operate in a more clandestine way. And tomorrow morning we're going to show this film cover-up, which gets at some of that. Just one observation here before going on. Low-intensity conflict is a racist strategy. It's based on the assumption that those of us in this room and other people in this country don't really care about atrocities committed against other peoples, usually who are dark-skinned. It's banking on our racism, that we won't value the human lives of Central Americans as much as we value the life of a U.S. soldier. And I think that that's been confirmed over and over again, that they're right. It's somehow something that we need to counter. Okay, a third lesson from the Vietnam War is that the U.S. people are the enemy. From the reading of history that they have, they say that the U.S. people lost the war. They didn't have the commitment. They're so worried about this Vietnam syndrome now because the U.S. people didn't have the commitment to see that war through to its logical conclusion, or weren't willing to let the military use nuclear bombs in Vietnam, etc. I've got lots of quotes here, I won't read them, but from U.S. planners who basically say that the real enemy isn't overseas, the real enemy are the hearts and minds of the U.S. people. In order not to lose the U.S. people, there's been a lot of deception and lies that have been targeted to us. So disinformation campaigns targeted at everyone in this room and the U.S. people are central to low-intensity conflict strategy. Low-intensity conflict itself is a low-visibility warfare strategy. It's trying to keep the wars that the United States is engaged in less visible from us. Then there's active deception, in which the Pentagon, the State Department, and others have the capacity to flood literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of press releases over a year, more than 600 in the case of the Pentagon and the State Department, that basically shapes the debate in this country. You also have the White House issuing 15 to 20 press releases every day. And I'll ask you to read news stories in major newspapers, and you'll be shocked, I think, at how many of the stories come with their bylines based on those kinds of press releases. You've got the CIA planting false stories in foreign newspapers that get picked up and reported here with no one knowing when they're reading the story that in fact was written by the CIA for subversive purposes at home. You have, according to some former CIA officials, many CIA people writing for major U.S. newspapers in the United States. In other words, when you pick up your New York Times or maybe even your Seattle paper, you may in fact be reading stories that are being written by people who are on the payroll of the Central Intelligence Agency. Something that's supposed to be illegal, but apparently is still going on. Then you also had, under the Reagan administration, the transferring of psychological warfare operations specialists who worked overseas, transferring them into the domestic arena. And they created an agency called the Office of Public Diplomacy. And the Office of Public Diplomacy were responsible for, remember the famous MIG crisis in Nicaragua, when Nicaragua was having elections and the U.S. was having elections, and instead of you hearing about Nicaragua's fair and free elections, what you heard about was that Nicaragua was getting advanced fighter jets from the Soviet Union, and the Democrats and the Republicans were tripping over each other about who would kill the Sandinistas first. That was brought to us by the Office of Public Diplomacy. One senior U.S. official quoted in the Miami Herald said, quote, "The Office of Public Diplomacy was carrying out a huge psychological operation of the kind the military conducts to influence the population in denied or enemy territory," end quote. Well, that's the point. We're now considered enemy territory. Robert Owen, by the way, do you know who Robert Owen was? He was Oliver North's chief courier to the Contras. He ran a thing called IDEA Incorporated, and he got humanitarian aid that went to the Contras. He got this, and his job was to create a positive image for the Contras in the United States. Robert Owen was an aide to Dan Quayle. It's one of the connections. Robert Owen was also a link between Dan Quayle and John Hull. And John Hull is from Indiana, who also owns a ranch in Costa Rica, which is the transshipment point of illegal arms shipments to the Contras a couple of years ago, and it was also the transshipment point of drugs that was then loaded on planes from his ranch and shipped into the United States. Okay. A fourth lesson is the central role assigned to terrorism within low-intensity conflict. That terrorism is viewed as absolutely central to U.S. policy. Now, the goal, however, is to use terrorism to link it to specific political objectives. And just a couple of words about this. In El Salvador, we've gone through different management of terror phases. In 1980, 1981, when Romero was assassinated, when the church women, U.S. church women were killed, there were literally hundreds of bodies that would appear in the streets weekly in El Salvador. The goal was to literally cut off the heads of the popular movements. Popular movements of students, workers, farmers, teachers, health workers, organizing, demanding change that's about to take power in El Salvador, met with massive repression. Then you go again around 1983, 1984, and the tactic shifts to more selective repression. People in Congress were finding a little bit harder time to fund the atrocities. Our Western European allies were accusing the United States of funding terrorists. A whole lot of public relations problems for the U.S. And so what they did was they selected the Duarte regime. The Duarte figure, a good Christian Democrat who could provide a good image. Meanwhile, we increased the power of the military, the U.S. Embassy remained at the pinnacle, etc. So selective repression. In El Salvador today, and I'll maybe come back to this, the popular movement built again. All that repression wasn't sufficient to keep people down. The idea of targeted terror is you hope that the memory of past repression will keep the people silent. It's pretty much worked in Guatemala. But it hasn't worked very well in El Salvador. And so now we're entering a period of much more direct terror in El Salvador again. In the case of Nicaragua, there's compelling evidence that the U.S. selected and groomed the Contras because they were terrorists and groomed them in terrorism. There are secret defense intelligence reports in which, even according to U.S. policy statements, they labeled the largest Contra organization a terrorist group. We hired CIA Director William Casey, went down to Argentina, and hired the Argentinian generals to provide the training because we didn't want U.S. people openly training the Contras. Well, keep in mind what the Argentinian generals had just been doing to their own people. It had been a campaign of terror waged against them. Former Contra leaders like Edgar Chamorro and others testified before the World Court that when they complained about Contra atrocities against civilians and terrorism, that they were directed and told by the Central Intelligence Agency that the only way to win the war was through terrorism. You may remember that the CIA produced a manual for the Contras. One of the chapter titles of that manual was Implicit and Explicit Terror. And it basically laid out how to get your maximum political advantage out of terrorizing civilians. Lesson 5 from the Vietnam War was a need to redefine victory. Victory is now understood within low-intensity conflict under an understanding of a sliding scale of acceptable outcomes. So, for example, in the case of Nicaragua, the original goal was to try to overthrow the Sandinistas, and we provided the Contras with all kinds of military aid, all kinds of support to try to do that, and the Nicaraguan people successfully defended themselves, and it became fairly clear that that was not going to be an achievable goal. But there's a second definition of victory, which is simply make the country suffer. Suffering gets defined as victory against governments that we don't like. It's part of what's called pro-insurgency. We create an insurgency against governments we don't like, and we basically assign them the task of wreaking havoc. So the goal of the Contras quickly became not to win power in Nicaragua, but to destroy the Nicaraguan Revolution, force the country to shift resources from development into warfare. I got some quotes from William Casey, for example, who said that we might not succeed in overthrowing the Sandinistas, but that we could waste Nicaragua, waste the country. Or he said that it takes very few people and a little support to disrupt the internal peace and economic stability of a small country. I spoke with the foreign policy aide to a U.S. senator shortly upon my return from El Salvador, Nicaragua, this past December. And he said to me at the end of our conversation, this is a direct quote, he said, "Jack, you may not agree with us, but the lesson we've learned over the past 8 years is if you make people suffer, they're more willing to talk to you on your terms." It's an absolutely sinister. And that's why terrorism has been assigned such a central role in U.S. foreign policy related to Nicaragua, is because terrorism fits in so well with the idea of suffering as victory. And then, ironically, to some, another goal in terms of Nicaragua was to actually push Nicaragua into a dependency relationship on the Soviet Union, to help prove the worldview that says that essentially countries only have two choices. They can be dominated by the U.S. or they'll be defined as enemy, usually an enemy that is somehow supposedly subservient to the socialist bloc. Okay, two more things I want to do quickly, and then we'll open it up. One is just to give you some examples. I mentioned that it's kind of a totalitarian type strategy of warfare that integrates economic, psychological, diplomatic, and military aspects of warfare. I want to give you just a few examples from each of those categories so you'll understand more what I'm talking about. And then I want to offer just a couple of thoughts about the present situation in Central America. Okay, examples of economic warfare. Targeting aid. When the U.S. Was faced with a situation that the Sandinistas and the Nicaraguan people had thrown out a U.S.-backed dictator, we approved some aid to Nicaragua. But that aid was targeted to the wealthiest and richest sectors in Nicaragua. In other words, we tried to shore up the elite and tried to take away from or not encourage the more progressive elements in the Nicaraguan Revolution that in fact wanted to implement reforms. We cut off food aid and food sales to Nicaragua. We transferred Nicaragua's sugar quota so that Nicaragua couldn't export sugar to the United States under an agreement whereby you get above world market prices. Many of you know there's an economic embargo against Nicaragua. If any of you have tried to give money or assistance to Nicaragua, you'll know that groups like Oxfam and others have sometimes been harassed by the U.S. government as they've tried to deliver aid. More recently, the refusal to give aid to Nicaragua after the worst hurricane to ever hit that region any time in history that we know of, we didn't send 1 cent of relief to Nicaragua, and then we wonder why there are Nicaraguan refugees who are flowing into the United States. But two others to mention here. Debt is a weapon. One of the principal tools that the United States uses to get El Salvador and Honduras and other Central American countries to do what we want them to do rather than what they need to do for their own interests is we hold the debt that they have over them like a chopping block. So Honduras basically has no sovereignty. And the other that I've mentioned is the Contra War was and still primarily is the idea of trying to fund the Contras, humanitarian aid for another year, keep them alive, keep them on the border, is primarily designed to make it more difficult for Nicaragua to shift resources into development away from warfare. Just keeping them there for a year means it's much more difficult for Nicaragua to redevelop. Psychological war, constant threats of invasion. The invasion of Grenada, by the way, was part of a psychological warfare strategy against Nicaragua to make Nicaragua feel like they could be imminently invaded. It was also psychological warfare against the U.S. people because what had happened shortly before Grenada, you remember in Lebanon, how many Marines were killed? 218 or something like that. To try to get us out of that psychosis of U.S. people dying and get us back into the framework of the United States is strong and powerful and look, we invaded Grenada successfully. The MiG crisis was part of psychological warfare. Constant military maneuvers on the Honduran border. The U.S. finances. You've all probably heard that La Prensa on occasion has been shut down in Nicaragua. What you don't hear is that the United States controls most of the airwaves into Nicaragua. Most Nicaraguans have a much easier time hearing the U.S. perspective on what's happening in Central America than they do what the Nicaraguan perspective is, simply through control of airwaves that beam radio messages into Nicaragua from all the surrounding countries, as well as TV. The CIA, according to former Contra leaders that were managing propaganda operations, has on the payroll the major newspaper writers, major radio personnel in neighboring countries to project Nicaragua as the enemy in places like Honduras and El Salvador, and to beam into Nicaragua. I've listened to the Contra radio stations where they beam in things like, the Sandinistas are evil, they're sending our children to Cuba, we have food shortages because they send all of our food to the Soviet Union, they kill old people and make them into soap, a whole variety of things. That one was is my personal favorite. The CIA and the Office of Public Diplomacy and their disinformation campaigns, part of psychological warfare. The use of the National Guard and trying to keep the thing less visible to us as part of psychological warfare. And then repression is the main one. The managing of fear and terror in places like El Salvador is part of psychological warfare. Diplomatic political front, you may remember a man named Arturo Cruz. How many of you remember his name? Arturo Cruz is the guy that the U.S. government in 1984, when Nicaragua was holding presidential elections, said, if Arturo Cruz doesn't run, it can't be a fair election. Arturo Cruz doesn't run, etc. Well, Arturo Cruz, not surprisingly, didn't run. Arturo Cruz, about a year and a half ago, has now admitted that he was on the CIA payroll and was paid to not run in the election, and that there had never been any intent for him to run in the election because they knew that he didn't have, nor did any other opposition party have any kind of popular support in Nicaragua. So the only way for the U.S. to win the Nicaraguan election was to discredit it. And one way of doing that was to pay Arturo Cruz not to run. Breaking off bilateral talks, efforts to undermine the regional peace initiatives. Arias, the Costa Rican president, when he launched the so-called Arias peace plan, the U.S. responded to that by cutting off aid to Costa Rica as a form of punishment. It's diplomatic, political, as well as economic warfare. Paying defectors at key moments before congressional votes. A more recent example, good old freedom-loving Democrat Dan Quayle goes down to El Salvador and he tells them, you be careful about the death squad activity because our aid is going to be contingent upon that and we're going to be watching you. And then a couple days, or about a week or so, a couple weeks later, for the first time in the recent history of El Salvador, a military figure is going to be tried for a human rights violation. Now, what's interesting about that, it just happens to come at the time when the U.S. Congress is debating whether to provide $375 or $400 million more aid to El Salvador. That's part of diplomatic, it's part of political warfare. I don't believe for a moment that Dan Quayle is very concerned about the death squads in El Salvador. In fact, the U.S. Embassy helps direct the death squads in El Salvador. Okay, and then the last one I want to mention here under diplomatic political is the use of elections for undemocratic purposes. U.S. people like elections, and we think elections are a meaningful way of showing the power forces in a country and for people to choose. That's not what elections mean in Central America, and I'm not sure that's what they mean here. That's another issue we can come back to. But what they mean in the case of El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras is that the militaries and the oligarchies in those countries, along with the U.S. Embassy, have found elections convenient. Because the U.S. made major promises that if they would nominally have a civilian elected in an election, that the militaries would greatly enhance their power. That's exactly what has happened in each of those countries, particularly in El Salvador. Okay, military aspects of warfare, I've already mentioned some of those, the Contras, supporting Honduran armed forces, all those kinds of things, the military maneuvers, the National Guard training, U.S. advisors involved in training, the development of those quick strike forces I talked about earlier. But there's also things like third country suppliers. It's not a coincidence that whenever Congress decides that it's going to be difficult for them to sell something to the U.S. people, like ongoing military aid to the Contras, for example, that then you have Israel, you have Saudi Arabia, you have Taiwan, you have South Korea, all those wonderful democracies over there who come through with major military support. Israel gets, what, between $7 and $8 million a day from the United States, and it's willing to funnel some of that and do some favors. And of course the Iran-Contra thing is part of a similar thing. And then the covert actions the CIA, the secret teams, things like that, also come under the military. All right, very briefly then, just a quick synopsis of what I see happening in Central America right now. First, Nicaragua. From the perspective of low-intensity conflict, the United States policy has been a success in Nicaragua. Not the ultimate victory of overthrowing the Sandinistas. That hasn't happened. But in the sense of defining suffering as victory. Nicaragua has been effectively destroyed as a model for other third world countries who long to be free and long to reorient their resources. It'll be many, many years before, under the best of circumstances, that Nicaragua will in fact be able to repeat the stunning successes that it had in the first several years after getting rid of the US-backed dictator before it had the Contra War. They reduced their literacy by a third in 5 years. They reduced their literacy from 58% to 12% through a literacy crusade. Tremendous improvements in health care. Most of those have been eroded. So we're hearing a lot now about that is taking place between George Bush and Ronald Reagan. To a certain extent, there is a shift. George Bush is less committed to a military option. But it's important to understand that the military option really isn't an option because the Nicaraguans militarily defeated the conquerors. Also, in the framework of suffering as victory, this is a very flexible strategy that now, logically, the shift is to try to capitalize politically on the destruction that we've created inside of Nicaragua. In other words, the focus I expect in Nicaragua over the next several years will be to try to form some kind of coherent opposition and try to somehow increase the power of the wealthiest sectors in Nicaragua. Capitalize on the disenchantment from the war, the hurricane, the suffering, etc. Say that Sandinista's revolution has failed and try to provide some kind of political opposition. So we're not so much seeing a shift in policy as we are a logical tactic based on the fact that Nicaragua has been at least relatively destroyed over the last 8 years. Now the good news, at least from some of us, is that even the fact that Nicaragua still exists and that it still has some revolutionary goals, it still has some revolutionary reforms that have taken place in healthcare, in land, etc., is an amazing human accomplishment. Amazing accomplishment. And of tremendous importance to third world people. And it should be important to us as well. Okay. Guatemala. Essentially, in Guatemala, we hear very little about it, but and I'd be interested. I know Vicky's been there. I know some other people have been there. But my perception of my limited time in Guatemala was that what the election of Cerezo did, which was he was a civilian candidate, reasonably humane person, that he had very little power, and that what it had effectively done is it opened up channels to the United States to provide more support to the Guatemalan military. And the repression that has taken place in Guatemala over the years has been much, much more effective in silencing the people. It's almost impossible, in my experience, to have a direct conversation with anyone in Guatemala about what is going on in that country. You can visit Guatemala and you say, oh, look at the beautiful mountains and the people seem to be real nice and friendly. And there's just an incredibly sophisticated psychological network and kind of enough terrorism to keep people silent. Very, very effective. And while there is more organizing than there are some groups, I get most depressed in all the Central American countries. I get most depressed when I'm in Guatemala because the sophistication of the terror and the psychological manipulation of people is so complete. Honduras, poor Honduras. There's a joke about Honduras that says that Honduras is one of the only countries in the world that has to nationalize its own government. Honduras has almost no freedom. The most recent example of that is the Central American president signed an accord that was to dismantle the Contra. The Honduran president supported that, pushed for it along with the Nicaraguan president, because no one in Honduras supports the Contra. the rich don't want them there, the rich coffee growers, the small campesinos. There's no political party, the military doesn't want them, nobody wants them, except for the U.S. government. The U.S. government, right after Honduras, but the costs of that in terms of Honduras are enormous. The United States is creating a revolution in Honduras. We're fueling tremendous anti-American sentiment. We're fueling tremendous social turmoil because the causes of the poverty in Honduras get worse and worse and worse. And meanwhile, we've done what we always do, which is we've strengthened the military sector, which is the most reactionary sector throughout Central America. So I think the future for Honduras does not look very good. Costa Rica, also, we hold Costa Rica up as the model democracy. Costa Rica is in very, very bad shape economically. It's falling apart. Costa Rica has managed to avoid a lot of social turmoil because it structured its economy in a way that provided a lot of social benefits, including education and health care, to the majority of its people. A lot of those programs are now being slashed. The U.S. has conditioned aid on the privatization of the Costa Rican economy, so the Costa Rican government is being forced to dismantle some of its state controls of key industries that have been instrumental in that more equitable distribution of resources. And so by and large, again, I would predict that gradually we are eroding meaningful democracy in Costa Rica as a result of our policies. El Salvador is the place where the failure of low-intensity conflict is most clearly illustrated and where the U.S. faces the most difficult choices. The U.S. strategy in El Salvador was essentially this, and this is very similar to other low-intensity conflict strategies when we're backing unpopular governments. The idea was you implement cosmetic reforms to try to hold off deeper reforms. So the U.S. went into El Salvador and it said to the oligarchy, it said to the rich, for your own interests, for your own sake, you have to give a little. We at least have to have the appearance that we care about the poor. Otherwise, you're going to get thrown out. Well, the U.S. was effectively able, under Duarte, to use its influence to implement some cosmetic reforms. Cosmetic reforms do nothing to respond to the real social problems of the country. They do not do anything to really improve the power and position of the poor. So they don't work very well. But now we're in a situation in El Salvador in which the right-wing party Arena that didn't want those cosmetic reforms is now going to undo the cosmetic reforms. And meanwhile, again, we've strengthened the military. The military has been the biggest winner in the $3.2 billion that the U.S. has sent there in the last 7 years. So in El Salvador, this is what I predict. The U.S. has three choices. The best choice is that we do something like Gorbachev did in relation to Stalin. That is, Gorbachev said Stalin was a criminal. Wow, can you imagine living in the Soviet Union and how refreshing that would sound, you know, a wave of truth coming from a government leader that Stalin was a criminal. I hope I live long enough that a U.S. leader will stand up, George Bush or somebody will stand up and say, we have been exploiting Latin and Central America for generations. The policy that we've implemented there in the last 8 years is a nightmare and a disaster. We've got to encourage the kinds of reforms that are taking place in Nicaragua, et cetera, et cetera. That's what needs to happen, and in El Salvador that would mean, first of all, that we would say we need a negotiated settlement in El Salvador in which the FMLN and the popular organizations share power, because that's the reality of El Salvador. They are a major, probably the major power in El Salvador, is outside of the electoral process in any meaningful sense that we hold up for the democracy. So that's not going to happen. That's what we should do, and that's what we need to push for, but I don't think it's going to happen. A second option, as things unravel, and they are unraveling in El Salvador, is that the U.S. will send in troops. When low-intensity conflict strategy fails to do what the U.S. wants it to do, it's going to escalate into greater violence. Now, the U.S. doesn't want to do that, so I don't suspect that that's going to be our first choice. The next choice is to let ARENA do what ARENA has said that it wants to do. ARENA is the party that recently won the presidential elections in El Salvador. And what ARENA and the U.S. Embassy have been debating over the last few years and few months has been ARENA wants to kill 100,000 people in a year. It wants to unleash an incredible wave of terror in El Salvador, which would mean the assassination of Bishop Gomez, the Lutheran bishop. It would mean the assassination of labor union leaders. All kinds of people in the churches would be targeted for death in a massive wave of killing. Well, the U.S. has been saying for over the last few years, we don't want that. We want to manage this. We want more like 10,000 people dying a year. We want a low-intensity conflict. We don't want it to be that obvious. Congress won't fund it. We've got all kinds of tactical problems, etc. So now the debate is going on. But the point I'm trying to make here is that it's falling apart in El Salvador. And when it falls apart, I suspect that the real debate that's going to happen is this, and this is going to sound very radical, but I'm almost sure that this is happening, that this is one of the things being considered, is to say to ARENA, go for it. Do what you have to do to control the situation. Kill as many people as you need to kill. And our public position is going to be that we're going to condemn you and we're going to cut off your funds. But the Congress won't fund it. But we'll fund you through the CIA. And then, out of the ashes, gradually we'll be able to go through a process and say, well, things are now changing in El Salvador and we'll bring in some new faces to put in government and try to develop a democracy in the U.S. sense of that word. So that's my prediction. Another option, which is also fairly likely, would be simply to go the road of, okay, we need to escalate the repression as the popular movements continue to build and see if that will do the trick. But what I'm saying is I don't think that will keep the people from El Salvador from continuing to struggle. All right, final word. For me, as a Christian, this is the most sinister and cynical policy that I can imagine. And it really, with the way that I write about this, is I see it as an issue in confessional terms. And I'm not sure that I always mean by that confessional in the way that the churches in Nazi Germany said, we must declare ourselves a true church and resist this, and anybody who doesn't is a false church. I'm not interested in calling myself the true church. But it raises the question for me about ultimate allegiances. And right now, I think we're still living in a situation in which nationalism and patriotism and affluence and all those things are functional lords in our lives. And that a major challenge for us as people of faith is to resist and name and confront this policy, and to try to be, through our work, signs of solidarity and healing with our brothers and sisters in the faith throughout Central America. And this is not just happening in Central America. This policy was part of the strategy in Afghanistan. It was part of the strategy in Angola. It's been part of the strategy in Southern Africa. It's a global-wide strategy, the principal manifestation of which has been Central America. Okay, I'm going to stop it there, and we'll open it up. Just a couple of thoughts in response about kind of how does recruitment take place and who makes decisions and all those things. Essentially, there has been a tremendous amount of study, again, that was done since the Vietnam War within military circles and others about what are the threats to U.S. interests and what are more successful forms of intervention. So some of it is coming about a major rethinking within the military itself about how to effectively be a military to defend U.S. interests around the world. But you also then had, and this was greatly pushed forward in the Reagan administration, when the Reagan administration, through a whole lot of political appointments, basically placed people in positions of power within the agencies that you need to carry out a sophisticated strategy like this. William Casey died of a brain tumor. I sometimes wonder if that wasn't a little too convenient. William Casey died right before he was supposed to give testimony on what his role was in the Iran-Contra affair. But William Casey was a major, major architect of this, and he had at his disposal hundreds of millions of dollars through the Central Intelligence Agency. I'm not saying hundreds of millions of dollars went into this, but certainly millions did, in trying to create covert networks, in trying to develop the Contras illegally, a whole lot of resources there. You have, and one of the things that's very important about this strategy is that because it incorporates not just military power, you need psychological warfare operations, you need economic assistance. So you have, the United States has a huge humanitarian agency, quote-unquote, called the Agency for International Development, AID. Well, AID is now a major actor in low-intensity conflict. And what you had in the case of El Salvador was massive bombings in the countryside, and then AID would funnel money largely through the Salvadoran military. They'd go into the areas and say, well, we're kind of sorry we had to bomb and burn your homes and crops and stuff, but our real targets were the guerrillas, and we're really your friends. And to show you that we're friends, if you agree to be part of the Civil Defense Force, we're going to give you these rice and beans, and maybe we'll even build a school for you. So the Agency for International Development has a piece to play. So what you have is a very, as you say, comprehensive strategy, but you had a president of the United States, and you still do, who was committed, essentially, to integrating these different aspects of, or different organizations that connect with U.S. policy, that have an influence in controlling things overseas. So they had a vision, and they went after that vision and through the kind of appointments that they can make. So that's part of the answer. A more difficult part to answer is, where the heck is Congress in this? And does, I ask myself the question, for example, my representative is a man named Martin Sable in Minnesota. Relatively decent human being who has voted for the most part against military aid to the Contras. And I ask myself constantly, I've met him, I've talked with him, and I still don't know how much of what I lay out he knows or understands. I suspect that the problem is really this one. And I argue this in the book, whether I'm right or wrong, you can help me judge, is that what both Democrats and Republicans agree on is that the United States has the right to be an empire. What Democrats and Republicans agree on is that what they're elected to do are to preserve and protect the privileges of this country, and if possible, expand them. Now, they differ sometimes on tactics of how to do that. There are very few Democrats or Republicans who will tell you that the Sandinistas were good for Nicaragua. The Sandinistas were good for Nicaragua, and they would have been a whole lot better for Nicaragua had they had a chance to, in fact, carry out the revolution. They won't say that because they buy into a very similar worldview. And my suspicion is that most of them don't care enough about foreign policy, for one. They don't care enough about what's happening in Central America to pay attention to these details, that in effect, the whole strategy of low-intensity conflict in many ways has been designed to try to minimize Congress's role, to keep them out of the circle of having to know or wanting to know. So it's a fairly, it's a sinister relationship on the one hand, and it's on a less sinister basis, it just kind of flows out of the logic of a worldview of what you're around to do. If you add to that one other key ingredient, that when Martin Sable has a meeting with Jack Nelson Palmer and a few people, he does that, I think, probably more out of the fact that he needs to meet with some of his constituency, and if we demand, make enough demands, we'll get to hear from him every once in a while. That's very different than if someone from Honeywell wants to meet with Martin Sable, or someone from Cargill wants to meet with Martin Sable, because that's who Martin Sable represents. Martin Sable doesn't represent me. Martin Sable has to deal with me because I'm a member of his constituency. But who he really represents and who has his ear is a very different constituency that has much more in common with this worldview. So that's a fairly broad strokes answer, but I think it gives at least some of the components I have. Couple comments. One is that's why liberation theology is targeted as the enemy of the United States, and why foreign policy documents have said so, is because what liberation theology does at its very core is it lifts up the dignity of people, and it tells them encourages them and says to them that God doesn't will them to be poor, and then in fact that God is with them as they struggle for human dignity, and that what God wants for the whole human family is human dignity. Well, that's a message that if you see that message come alive in people, which I have done in Central America, it is an incredibly powerful message. And it's the kind of message that gives rise to the hope that we heard in an earlier quote from Romero, in which people are willing to live and orient their lives and organize amidst repression that we can hardly even imagine. And they don't lose their hope for the most part. I don't want to create an image that everyone in Central America is a saint and capable of way more hope than we are. In fact, that's the opposite of what I want to say. But the point I'm trying to make here is that that hope is considered very dangerous. Internally in the United States, hope is also considered dangerous. And I would say that we manifest, I mean, there's different ways that our government tries to deal with our hope. One of them is it downplays the level of resistance that exists in this country to present policies. By and large, there are thousands and thousands of grassroots organizations in this country who are mobilizing for a different future, who are protesting against the kind of policies that I've laid out here. And the amount of media coverage that they get is minuscule. And part of that, I think, is a fairly calculated strategy. Another example, one of the most dangerous things from the U.S. policy perspective was when on June 12th, 7 years ago this June 12th, 1 million people demonstrated in New York City. Several million were demonstrating in Europe, and what were they calling for? They were calling for a nuclear freeze, they were lifting up the questions of the nuclear arms race, and there were amazing campaigns to discredit that movement, as well as that's when we started to hear about Star Wars. Star Wars was in fact, in part, a psychological warfare against the U.S. people in which we were trying to project that the peace through strength image and the idea that through this technological wonder we weren't going to be preserving unjust privileges, we were going to create a shield that would make nuclear weapons unusable. Part of that is playing with hope. It makes hope dangerous here. Now, what I said at the meeting this morning was an observation that people were making these phrases or something similar in very close proximity in their sentences. One was, I feel powerless. And the other one was, I'm not sure I'd be willing to take that kind of risk. And my comment this morning was that I believe that if we're not willing to take risks, and I'm not sure how to define that, but it probably means things like, and we'll talk more about this tomorrow afternoon too, but it probably means things like tax resistance. It means things like more vocally talking about this stuff and naming it. It means radically simplified lifestyles. It means a whole lot of things. Unless we're willing to take risks that put us in conflict with the dominant culture, we automatically cut ourselves off from hope. Because we, in fact, are powerless at that point. If we're only willing to go to this point and say, no, it's going to affect my life now, I want to go back, then we are powerless. But what the Central Americans that I know have taught me, and whether they've taught me enough that I'm actually going to at some point be the first one with Casey. Casey very well could have died of a brain tumor. And just simply died of a brain tumor. That's probably the most likely scenario. And it's probably best to say that's probably what happened, to not even bring it up, because I think so much of what I say already is so off the mainstream of what people normally think about, it probably doesn't serve any useful purpose to speculate beyond that. But I have had doctors tell me that the likelihood of him having a tumor where he had it and dying of it is very unlikely, but it's possible. So it's a possibility. Now, in terms of Sapphire, someone told me one time, and I don't know that Sapphire is a CIA agent,
If any of you read his poems, he's a columnist for the New York Times who is, how would you describe him? He's a real ultra-rightist.
So is George Will, and they probably agree generally. And
Will is considered a little bit more moderate than Sapphire.
He's
probably
also considered to have integrity, I think. And I don't know about Sapphire. I worked for Nixon, and that kind of taints it.
I will tell you that the source of one of the sources that I have for the information about the CIA, in fact, does have people on writing for major media newspapers in the United States is John Stockwell. And John Stockwell is a former CIA official who was with the agency for many years, a long experience in Vietnam, was responsible for the efforts to destabilize Angola back in the mid-70s. And it's my recollection, but this is a fuzzy one, so I don't know, but it's my recollection, he mentioned specifically a name from the New York Times. So he did identify the New York Times as one of the papers that he knows had a CIA official who's writing for it, and I'm pretty sure he named Sapphire, but I don't know that. I believe that we don't have free press, but for a lot of other reasons. And so again, the farthest extreme, I have about a half of a chapter on a whole chapter on the undermining of democracy in the United States as a result of low-intensity conflict, and about half of that is focused on, if we have a free press, why are we so ignorant? And just a couple of observations that I make in that section is that, one, is simply that the media itself is a big business. And the media makes decisions, by and large, it makes business decisions about what to print and what not to print. By and large, most forms of censorship that we have in this country are not a government-controlled censorship. There have been cases of like that, like Grenada and others, but by and large, censorship takes place through a system of reporters and others knowing what they can print and what they can't print, through decisions that are made by boards of directors, decisions that are made about who to hire as your editors, etc. And I know a number of journalists who write for publications like the Minneapolis Tribune, National Catholic Reporter, and others, who have told me that their articles are sometimes not printed and sometimes gutted, and they're sometimes told to write stories that are the opposite of what they perceive to be happening in Central America, for example. So there's a lot of that kind of pressure. What other kinds of things could I bring up there? But the point I'm trying to make is that if we rely upon CBS, ABC, NBC, and your major newspapers for news, I think we're going to have a pretty distorted view of what's going on in the world. And that what we do have in this country, fortunately, is there's a lot of good information around, and I really believe that we can find out what's happening, and we have the freedom to do that. The problem is that doesn't help very much in terms of shaping the overall public debate in this country, because the number of people that have access or choose to have access to those other viewpoints are very small relative to the major media. So I don't know whether the New York Times is complicit and knows that it has CIA people writing for it, or whether it doesn't. In either case, it's problematic, and in either case, the New York Times has a lot of other things going on in it that prevents it from going very far outside the acceptable parameters of debate. Just call your attention to one book that I find helpful on this subject. Is a book by it's actually a Marxist sociologist named Michael Parenti, parent with an I, Parenti, who's written a book called Inventing Reality. And he says, because the New York Times is perceived as being the best newspaper in the country, that's the one I'm going to go after. And he just documents over and over and over and over again cases of pretty poor coverage. And if you want to have a real... I enjoy reading him on occasion just because he minces no words. Read Noam Chomsky. And one of his recent books is called The Culture of Terrorism, in which he is kind of constantly digging barbs into the media for why they don't do a very good job. And I think, however you feel about his style of writing, it's pretty hard to disagree. Yeah, the main problems that we have, I believe, in this country are we have many more problems with self-censorship than we do with official government censorship, and that's true with what I call self-censorship of the press, and it's true with what I would call self-censorship of the church, that most pastors know what the line is, and if they cross the line, they're going to go and get into trouble. Some are willing to cross that line. The vast majority are not. Now, part of that is also related to the reason that I am so strongly committed to Christians living in an alternative way is simply because the more that we're locked into the values and goals of the dominant culture, the less freedom that we have. And if we want to have freedom in any meaningful sense, I think we need to live in an alternative way. And I think that's for the church. And the church, unfortunately, in my view, the point that it comes up with being powerless is that it's the same kind of discussion we were having earlier. Maybe you get to this point and you say, uh-oh, if I really withdraw my money from South Africa, I'm not going to have as much available in my pension fund. So I'm powerless, so I'm going to go in a different direction. There's all kind, or a pastor can say, geez, if I really talk about a war against the poor, I'm going to get kicked out of here. I'll never be able to do anything. And I'm not trying to minimize the tension. The tensions are very real, and the costs, the risks that we take are very real. But the only way that I see around that, well, there isn't a way around it, but one way that we can live, I think, with more integrity in the midst of it is to be living enough on the edge that we don't need big income, so that doesn't have to be the determining factor of what we do. So I think self-censorship of the church is an enormous problem. And I think that...
We had a meeting of...
Three quick thoughts. So that we don't downplay the church too much, there are a number of... there's some conference held about a year or two ago in which some U.S. military leaders were speaking, and they said... our most difficult challenge are the churches. And so they've already defined the church in the United States as a special need area to sell their perspective because they feel threatened by what is happening within some of the churches. So that's, you know, a little pat on the back. But where we are in terms of where we need to be as a church, I think we're real, real far, far away from it. The other thing I would say is just to share with you an experience that was somewhat new for me when I was in El Salvador, Nicaragua in December. At least it wasn't this clear to me, or said this clearly to me. And that was Christians from El Salvador and Nicaragua said to me in December, they said, until you are willing to take risk division, risk conflict, and almost polarize yourself in the churches, you will be worthless to us. And those are strong words, but essentially I think what they were saying, when they were, I was in Central America, Nicaragua is devastated by a U.S.-backed war, devastated by a hurricane, and the whole world is focused on two or three whales. You know, and here we are, you know, we talk about law, we don't even know about low-intensity conflict, let alone the human carnage that has meant in Central America. And they finally just said, what the hell are you doing as people of faith? And when are you going to be willing to take risks that, in fact, will polarize? And I've done a number, and I don't know, maybe we can do this as part of a group of people who want to do this, we can spend at least a few minutes on it. But I'll encourage you to do it on your own. I would like to think about who Jesus was and what Jesus did in his ministry. And just to share, my conclusion is that Jesus believed that in order to come or to overcome a conflictual situation, the conflict had to be in the open. You had to deal with it. And so he spoke truth to the powerful. He warned the rich. He told the rich young ruler that he had to sell everything and go follow the poor. He didn't mince words. And we can look at a whole number of things that Jesus did in his ministry that indicates that we do need. That doesn't don't get me wrong, that doesn't mean I think we should seek to polarize for polarized sake, that we should go out there and have an attitude that the rest of you are idiots and we know what the truth is. I can't stand that stuff, so if I start falling into it myself, please tell me. But the point I'm trying to make is that in the midst of this, we're going to have to be willing to gear our life and our work and our priorities to other than the lowest common. Had no reaction yet from within the circles of government, and I'm a little bit nervous about going back to El Salvador, to tell you the truth, because I know, well, it'll be interesting to see if I get back into El Salvador, for example. That would be one implication. A second implication I've been expecting for a long time is to have my taxes audited, but that hasn't happened yet either. My wife and I live below a taxable income, so maybe they figure that they don't even want to look at it because we earn so little anyway. But that would be another kind of ramification that would be fairly easily done as a form of at least letting me know that they're watching. I have no doubt that I and probably some others in this room have a fairly sophisticated file. But in terms of, you know, I don't know of any government official who has read it or who has held it up and said, we've got to take this seriously, or who has said this is the kind of trash we've got to come to stop. What I have, I mean, it's only been out for a month and a half or something. What I have had is some real encouraging indication that the book is hitting a sensitive chord among a variety of different groups. And, I mean, there's some natural ones like Witness for Peace and groups that have spent a lot of direct time in Nicaragua. But part of what I'm involved with, and we maybe can talk about this at the 4 o'clock time tomorrow too, is there's a whole kind of wellspring that I sense that's going on where people are starting to try to figure out what is our Kairos situation. Picking up on the term used in South Africa, where they produced a document called the Kairos Document that really attacked the heresy of apartheid. So I've been in touch with some what I call progressive theologians and have circulated the document, and this book is kind of circulating as part of that, and there's some very interesting things bubbling up at that level as well as on a kind of grassroots progressive Christian network level. And I also recently got an invitation, in fact, the day before I left to come here, that the Board of Global Mission for the United Methodist Church is having their board meeting, and they're bringing someone in from Angola to talk essentially about low-intensity conflict in Angola, someone from South Korea to talk about the implications of U.S. policy in that country, and someone from Brazil to address the debt crisis. And they've invited me to come in and kind of provide an overall framework of low-intensity conflict. So at that level, even within the upper levels of the United Methodist Church, it's getting out and stimulating something. So, you know, I told someone over dinner that the only way a book like this will ever get pushed around is if people who have some kind of connection to the issue find it useful and promote it at a local level. So there's some indication that that's happening. Well, that was the other option, and I have to give Orbis credit. Orbis, I've been told that other publishers oftentimes will really try to kind of reshape what you've written or tell you, no, you really can't say this, or don't you really mean X or whatever. I mean, they've been very good about just letting me speak. But we did have a discussion about the title, and the initial title that I had in mind was the U.S. War Against the Poor. And we decided to call it, and I guess I agree with him, War Against the Poor, because while we've been focusing, and we should as U.S. people, the war against the poor is a much broader war than just what the U.S. is doing, although we, I think, have about the most sophisticated strategy of carrying it out. And as Christians in this country, that gives us